This is an ABC podcast.
Remember around this time last year when the scenes of frantic hospital wards in Spain and Italy started appearing on our TV screens? When nurse Simone Sheridan saw them, she knew that she had to help, not if, but when the coronavirus got to Australia. So when the call was put out for nurses to retrain for the intensive care unit, Simone put her hand up. Then one of her good friends, the author Alsa Wild, thought her way to help would be to listen to what Simone was going through and to write about it. So Simone and Alsa spoke, late at night when Simone was off a shift, or on tea breaks, or as she walked the deserted Melbourne neighbourhoods. And sometimes Simone was exhausted and scared, and sometimes she was hopeful and proud. The result of those conversations is a book, The Care Factor. And Simone Sheridan is my guest today. Hi, Simone.
Hi, Sarah. Nice to be here.
How did a conversation on a plane some years ago change your career direction?
Oh, that conversation really changed my career direction. I didn't know that I was going to be a nurse. It wasn't something that I'd dreamt of as a young child. I actually was studying veterinary. I studied veterinary science for 3 years, and I guess because I'd done quite well at school and I'd really loved learning, there were certain careers that seemed open to me. You know, people said, oh, do you want to do medicine? Do you want to do engineering? Do you want to do vet or law? You know, sometimes physiotherapy made it into that. And because I lived in WA, they always suggested mining or geophysics, which I probably could have made a lot more money doing. But I chose veterinary because I had guinea pigs and rabbits and I loved being around animals. And 3 years into my veterinary studies, I kind of felt like I didn't really know who I was as a person. I think I'd spent so much time learning and growing academically, but I didn't really have a good sense of who I was. And so it was at that point I decided to go traveling overseas and to see what else was out there in the world and what I might be drawn to. And there were a few experiences I had overseas that made me really think about being in a people-focused career. And so for some reason, I picked occupational therapy. Look, to be honest, Sarah, I knew nothing about OT, but it just sounded good. And I thought, that sounds like a good, helpful career. Great, I'm going to do that. And so while I was on my way back from Africa, actually, my dad had actually asked him to enroll me into occupational therapy. But that conversation on the plane that you're talking about, I was actually flying back from Johannesburg and it was a very turbulent flight and I was feeling quite nauseous. I get quite motion sick. And the woman sitting next to me was actually the director of nursing from a UK hospital. And she was so good. She was so calm. She was so caring. She kind of looked after me and really helped me breathe through the nausea. And as the plane settled down, she asked me about what I was doing for work and, you know, what I was planning to do in terms of my career. And I told her about OT and she said, well, can I ask you something? Have you ever thought of being a nurse? And I had this little spark inside of me because it triggered a memory. Back when I was studying vet, I used to spend a lot of time at my best friend's house, and her mum was a nurse. And her mum would come home with these fantastic stories. And I'd always had this little seed of light in me that I remembered thinking at one point, maybe I could be a nurse. But then I squashed it because I thought, there's probably a reason why this career choice hasn't been offered to me. Maybe I'll get bored. It couldn't be further from the truth. But maybe there's a reason. And when this wonderful woman on the plane said to me, have you ever thought about being a nurse? It just lit that flame. And by the end of that plane flight back from Johannesburg, I was sold. That's it. I got off the plane and I was going to do nursing.
What about your dad, though? He'd gone to enroll you in OT.
That's the interesting thing. I felt so sorry because, you know, I'd been having these conversations with Dad, you know, over long distance from Africa, trying to get him to help me organise studies. And when I got off the plane, I said, I'm so sorry, Dad. I know you've gone to all that work to get me into OT, but I think I want to do nursing. He just looked at me and laughed because he said, do you know what? As a mature age, getting into OT, it was quite a tricky. And so when I spoke to someone at the university, they said the best thing to do is enroll her in nursing. She can do a year of nursing and then transfer across. So I was already enrolled. So it was like this magical coming together of like, no, I feel like this is the right path for me.
So thanks partly to your dad, thanks partly to this nurse you met on the plane, you enrolled in nursing and studied your degree. What kind of nursing did you end up specialising in, Simone?
So I studied my nursing in Western Australia and then I came across to Melbourne because I knew that I wanted to travel. And so that was it was meant to be the first of many stops, but I've landed here and loved Melbourne. And at the time, I wasn't sure what kind of nursing I would like to do. And so after my graduate year, I became an agency nurse, which meant that I worked at all different hospitals around Melbourne and tried out lots of different areas. But I was really drawn to oncology nursing, and when I went to work at Peter Mac as an agency nurse, I really felt like I was really invited into that, and I felt like it really aligned with who I was.
Tell me about Peter Mac. What kind of place is that? What's special about it?
So when I started working at Peter Mac, it was based in East Melbourne, and people used to call it a country hospital in the city. So it's a hospital that specialises in treating cancer patients. It's the only hospital of its kind in the Southern Hemisphere, and it has a fantastic reputation in terms of its holistic care for cancer patients, and it's a public hospital. And they had a course going in the high dependency unit, or the intensive care unit, where I could do a course that would eventually lead to me becoming an intensive care nurse. But an intensive care nurse who specialised in oncology or looking after cancer patients. And so once I started along that journey, it really became clear that intensive care nursing was something that was, it was such an incredible form of nursing. To be able to be given, it felt like a privilege to be at someone's side during an incredibly vulnerable time, but also to be able to have just one patient or one or two patients to really focus on what was happening for them and learn about what was going on in their body. And I think my studies with veterinary had really kind of given me a passion for learning about anatomy and physiology, and intensive care nursing really kind of gave me a chance to translate that into a human body.
You didn't stay there though. You didn't stay in intensive care nursing. Why not?
No. So I spent 8 years in intensive care and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. But I was really drawn towards education. And I really have to, I think I have to really give a big shout out to my mum. My mum's a teacher, and she really gave me the love of learning, but also the love of teaching people in a really engaging way. Like I loved being part of supporting new students when they came to the intensive care unit. I loved supporting new graduates. So when an opening became available to train as a clinical teacher, and that is to support new students at Peter MacCallum at the time when I was working there, I jumped at that opportunity. And I always kept a foot in the door of ICU. So I always kept working, you know, one shift a week or two shifts a week, because I loved that connection. But there was something about being part of the career journey and the growth of new nurses that I really thrived on. And I'm so proud now, because so many of the nurses at Peter Mac were actually students of mine from years ago. And so now they're in positions of being nums, and they're running wards, and they're doing incredible research. And I have this like really kind of lovely inner pride for meeting them when they were just junior nurses.
What about working in sexual health and family violence? Because that's two areas that you focused on. How did that come into your career?
I think one of the things that I've found across my life is it's very hard for me to narrow my interests. You know, at high school, I was always the student where they're like, Simone, you need to pick less subjects. And I think the same in nursing. I remember when I was at university, there was a nurse who came and spoke to us, and she told us about her career. And she'd had the most diverse career, and she'd worked in all of these different areas. And so I had this dream of being able to do the same, to be able to look at all of the different aspects of nursing and how I could be involved. And one of those areas was sexual health. So while I was working as an educator, I did some training through Family Planning Victoria. And then I started working as a sexual health nurse consultant at the Austin. And that was a really different role entirely. So this is much more of a kind of a counselling, conversational role, working with patients who've experienced sexual changes as a result of their illness or their injury. It's something that I'd encountered at Peter Mac, you know, people who'd been through cancer treatment, the challenges that then posed to them, not just at a physical level afterwards and emotional, but also in connecting with partners and just looking at how their body had changed. And so I guess I was really interested in this topic. It felt like something we didn't talk about a great deal in healthcare. And the more I looked at the research, the more I saw that patients and clients really want us to. They really would like to be asked about intimacy and sexual health. And I thought there was definitely an avenue there that I could help, not only in terms of providing those consultations, but providing education to healthcare staff to be able to have those conversations. And that's something that I still do today, run workshops for healthcare professionals, encouraging everyone to be able to talk about sex and intimacy, and really sort of just getting rid of the taboo around that.
That's easier said than done, though, Simone. Like, how was it for you asking, you know, or having some awkward conversations? Was that something that came easily to you?
One of the interesting things in my career is I feel like I've carved a bit of a niche for myself in terms of asking awkward questions and asking difficult questions, but also helping support others to have those conversations. And it was very nerve-wracking for me the first time I talked to someone about sex. And it actually wasn't even when I was working as a sexual health nurse. It was back when I was working at Peter Mac as an ICU nurse. And there was a young patient who'd had He'd had some bowel surgery that had meant that he now had a stoma bag, and things had changed quite dramatically for him in his pelvic region. And he was no longer able to have sexual intercourse or sexual activity in the way that he used to with his male partner. And this was something that came up. He asked me, you know, often this happens for nurses in the middle of a night duty when everything's dark and quiet, that people reveal those fears. And he told me about he was really scared about what this meant for his relationship, and he didn't know who to talk to. He didn't know what to do about it. And at the time, as an ICU nurse, I could listen, but I didn't really know either, and I didn't know where to go to. So it really became, you know, one of those passions that I had of I want to learn more about this, and I want to be able to give people the tools, because healthcare professionals, we all think someone else is having these awkward conversations. We all think, you know, the nurses think it's okay, the doctors have got that, and the doctors think, I'm sure the physios are talking about it. Everyone thinks someone else is having these conversations. But in actual fact, it comes down to it's all of our roles, because it's more about the connection we have with that person.
In your experience, Simone, might people open up more easily sometimes with a nurse than another kind of health professional?
Yeah, I really feel like there is something about nursing that does create a certain level of intimacy. You know, nurses are the ones who they're with people for so much longer. Like I'm thinking about a nurse on a ward, you know, is with that person for 8 or 12 hours of the day, and then potentially coming back day after day. Other health professionals will come in and spend some time, but that detailed amount of time and that involvement in intimate tasks, helping someone in the shower, helping someone to get dressed or to wash themselves, you know, taking out drains out of someone's body, those kind of really personal and intimate tasks do open up a level of conversation. And, you know, the amount of intimate conversations I've had in bathrooms with people, it's a place where people often open up. And it's interesting when you were saying about nurses having these conversations, it made me think about the other area of my work in terms of family violence. And we know that family violence is a health issue. We know it's everyone's responsibility to be able to recognize the signs. But we also know it's such an incredible opportunity, because nurses being at people's bedsides or being in such close contact with people, I guess they're in a position to notice those more subtle signs. Nurses are very good at reading relationships and reading between the lines, and they often get a gut feeling that something's not okay. But for many years, nurses weren't empowered to have those conversations. They weren't told that it was their responsibility. And in actual fact, they were told that's somebody else's, that's the social worker's job, or that's private and we don't go there. And I think I'm really inspired about the family violence training that we're doing in hospitals now, because we're really encouraging all health professionals and nurses to be able to have these conversations. And people are responding to nurses in a different way as well. They're feeling safe to be able to share and seek help.
Do you remember, Simone, first hearing last year about this new virus, coronavirus?
I do. And I feel very naive thinking back now. I'd heard a little bit about it in January. I remember reading about it in the paper about what was happening in China. And having, you know, a little bit of a, like, I wonder, but I wasn't overly scared at that point. And I was actually, I remember I went across to see my family in WA in February, early March last year. And so that was really where things were starting to happen in Australia. But the conversation was much more around, this is just a flu. It's just another virus. Everyone's making a big song and dance about it. You know, it probably affects the people that were going to have a cruise ship holiday this year. But apart from that, and especially in Western Australia, the feeling was that it was going to be okay. It was all right. And I guess I sort of had a beautiful holiday with my family. I'm so glad I did now, because it was right before all this happened, where we were caravanning and we weren't really engaging with the news that much. And so when I came back to Melbourne, it really felt like I landed squarely back into some pretty big conversations. And it really hit home when we started talking about it at the hospital. And I follow a lot of international nurses who work in the UK and in other overseas countries. And I started seeing what was happening at the ground level there. And I did get that feeling of worry. And I remember that first time we all gathered together and, you know, in a lecture theatre at the Royal Melbourne to look at what could happen in Melbourne. And there was an epidemiologist who actually put up a graph of saying, you know what, we actually think this is going to come to Australia. We've started seeing some cases. And judging by what's happening overseas, we're going to see those case numbers rise in April, and they're going to peak around June, July, and then it's going to plateau after that. And we actually talked about, this is quite funny when I think about it now, we talked about a big group hug that was going to happen in late July, August. Like, we were going to be through it and it was going to be over. And the thing they kept saying to us in the hospital was that we have the benefit of time, because we had some planning time that other countries didn't have. And so that's when it really started hitting home that we were preparing for something that was really, really serious.
Did you immediately decide you'd put your hand up to go back into ICU?
When I heard that there was going to be a need for intensive care beds, and that was the big worry was around emergency care and intensive care beds. It was the thing that we'd seen overseas, that people weren't able to access a ventilator, that decisions were being need to be made about who was going to get onto a ventilator and who wasn't. When I heard that, I knew that I had to be involved. I'd been trained as an intensive care nurse, so I'd completed all the necessary qualifications. And that was in a very specialised environment, but I still had the skills around supporting an intensive care patient, and I could work a ventilator. And I knew that the Royal Melbourne Hospital was needing to expand its intensive care beds, almost tripling the amount of beds that it was going to have. And to do that, you can't train ICU nurses that fast. You know, the kind of training that I'd had takes 18 months at least to be able to put you through. And so we couldn't get nurses at the bedside that quickly. So I actually wrote to the manager of the ICU at the Royal Melbourne and said, look, this is my experience in the past. She knew me personally and she knew that I'd had experience. And I said, I'm not sure if I'm useful, but if I can be useful, I'd like to be there.
You'd had this experience and the training in ICU. Did that mean you could walk straight into a ward again?
Definitely not. Look, the intensive care training that I'd had, I hadn't actually worked at the bedside in ICU for about 5 years at that point. I had maintained a connection with working in intensive care through my casual work at Peter MacCallum. I work with their high acuity team. So I'd still maintained a connection with keeping my own professional development up in that area. But in terms of working at the Royal Melbourne, this is a big trauma ICU. They use different ventilators, different equipment from what I was used to.
In that 5 years, which on one hand isn't really that long, but is the changes not so much in the kind of cases you'd be seeing, but the technology or the machinery you'd be using?
Everything updates. I guess it's like, you know, every year where we get a new iPhone, we get new updates to technology. So you could kind of look at it as if I was trained, you know, on an iPhone 5 and now we're up to an iPhone 12 or an old Nokia to an iPhone. And so there was some things I needed to learn about how the technology had changed. But I guess the basis of how an intensive care nurse keeps their patients safe and the anatomy and physiology of humans doesn't change that quickly. For me, though, there was some extra learning around working with patients who'd had neurological conditions such as a stroke or a brain bleed or a cardiovascular condition that I might not have cared for at Peter Mac. So it was some extra specialty knowledge as well.
And was your role to care for COVID patients in particular, Simone?
So I was brought in as part of a group of nurses that were being brought back in, like I was, either, you know, out of retirement or out of other project roles. But also we were bringing in a lot of nurses who were registered nurses, not ICU trained nurses, and they were getting a fast track course in ICU. So as part of that group of nurses, we initially were brought into ICU, I guess, to relieve the pressure on ICU so that the more experienced ICU nurses could take care of the acutely unwell COVID patients. So initially, no, I was caring for patients who were, I guess, all of the other reasons that you end up in ICU, you know, that somebody's had a heart attack and needed CPR or they've had surgery. And so I guess my initial meeting of COVID patients was often through a glass screen.
Was the ward, the ICU unit, set up differently given that you were all waiting and handling COVID patients?
Yeah, so the way that the intensive care unit at the Royal Melbourne is set up, it's divided into various pods. And these pods, it had actually been designed with pandemic purposes in mind. So these pods can actually be sealed off from other pods. So initially there was the decision that certain pods would be where the COVID patients would be located, but also in those pods there'd be patients who didn't have COVID as well, because we needed to use all of these beds. But the good thing about the way that it's set up is that everyone has their own space and we can actually completely close off a room from other patients, very different to the ICU that I grew up in, where everyone was in one room together and it was all open plan. There was something that we were hearing about overseas, which was that patients with COVID were doing better if they were nursed prone, which means on their stomach. And that's a very unusual thing for Australian intensive care units to do. So we all had to have training into how, because it takes many people to turn someone onto their stomach.
Why would that be? Why are there better results for people lying on their stomach, particularly if they're on a ventilator?
Particularly if they're on a ventilator, it's to do with air pressures and the way in which COVID impacts someone's lungs. There's been a lot of, it's even prior to COVID, there was a lot of studies about the benefits of actually moving people so that different areas of their lungs were up and different areas down. And it really helps perfuse the areas of the lungs that might not be so damaged by COVID as well. So people were recovering quicker when they had this therapy.
You were there working in the ICU unit before the first COVID patients came in. Was the feeling like you're waiting for the storm to break? What was the atmosphere?
You know, I think that for me, there was so many incredibly stressful times over the pandemic last year, but I feel like that to me was one of the highest anxiety times. And I had a dream several nights in a row that I dreamt of a tsunami. I dreamt that I was standing on a beach and there was a tsunami offshore and it was coming and I had nowhere to run. And that was the feeling that a lot of us had. We kept reassuring ourselves that we had time to prepare, and this was something that other hospitals didn't have. We had time to stockpile PPE. We had time to work out what were going to be the best ways of moving patients throughout the hospital, how we're going to divide up our teams. But there really was this sense of anticipation and what is it going to be like. And at the same time, we were seeing the devastation that was happening in Italy and in the UK and in the US and just waiting for it to come. And it was actually, in some ways, it was a relief when it started. Do you know, because then we actually had, we had a job to do and we knew what that job was.
As COVID patients or potential COVID patients started coming into ICU, you were needing to protect yourselves with all of that PPE. What was it like donning all of that protective gear? Talk me through it.
Donning and doffing PPE, as we call it, putting it on and taking it off, was something, the process and the steps involved did change slightly over the time of COVID as we started to learn about what was the best way to do things. And it was a really methodical process that we had to go through, which involved hand hygiene, wearing gloves, wearing a gown, wearing a mask, wearing a face shield. But the order in which we had to do these things was really important because you didn't want to contaminate a part of your body without previously having performed your hand hygiene. We knew as well that actually from overseas that taking your PPE off was one of the most dangerous times. And that was because quite often you were so keen, you know, you were hot and sweaty and your face it was hurting from the mask. And the temptation was to go straight to your face and pull off your mask and pull off your face shield when you left that person's room. But it was really important that you followed the order of taking PPE off in order to minimize the risk of you actually transferring those viral particles onto parts of your body where then you could end up contracting COVID as well. And we learned about something through this time. We also learned about something called bin wind. I remember the manager of ICU saying, who knew we'd actually be talking about bin wind? But we had these big yellow bins where we'd put our gowns and gloves into. But of course, they had big lids on them. And every time you close the lid, there was a chance that airflow through the lid closing would mean that those viral particles were dispersed. So then we had to change the style of bins that we were using so that we didn't develop bin wind. Like that was one of the odd things that we never thought we'd be talking about.
When you were wearing the full PPE, Simone, which aspect was most uncomfortable for you?
For me, it was definitely the face shield. I know for some people, the masks were incredibly uncomfortable. And the longer you wore those tight-fitting N95 masks for, the more uncomfortable they became in terms of pressure across the bridge of your nose. But for me, I think being able to see someone directly without looking through a plastic shield felt like the way that it's the way I connect with people, you know, being able to share that eye contact. And there was something about this big plastic shield that sat in front of your face that also reflected your own voice back at you. You know, it kind of had a strange echo chamber of your own voice, but it really felt to me like it was this very visible distinction between myself and the person I was caring for. And for that reason, I hated it. I also hated it because I didn't realize the first time I put it on, they actually come with a plastic film on the top of the actual plastic and then a plastic film on top. And you have to peel that plastic film off before you put it on. And the first time I'd forgotten to take it off. So the first time I spent, you know, an hour or so in with a patient looking through this fog going, gosh, this is really bad. But I learned after that you take the plastic film off.
Did patients respond differently to you? I mean,
it's incredibly scary as well, only seeing people behind a face shield and behind a mask. I think it made it really even more important to look for those moments of connection where we could. And, you know, having gloves on but being able to hold someone's hand and being able to take the time to talk to them, I think everyone was responding differently and we were all trying hard to make that connection through the plastic.
How did you make connection with patients behind all of that armour?
behind all, it did feel like armor at times as well. And, you know, and it made noises when you walked like armor would as well. I think for me, it's always been really important to see the whole person that's in front of me. And when you're in somewhere like intensive care, there are so many machines and things that go beep and monitors and alarms that are happening. And it can be very easy to focus on the machines and monitoring everything. And I think that's obviously a very important part of an intensive care nurse's job. But for me, it became really important about finding out something about that person. And I'm talking about intensive care patients who aren't sedated and ventilated, because obviously then you are just about the machines and caring for that person. But with patients who are awake, as many patients in ICU are, finding out something about them. You know, I remember there was a woman who'd had some brain surgery, and I was checking her armband to give her some medication, and I realized she had the same birthday as me. And I was like, oh, 9th of January, that's my birthday as well. And we had this lovely conversation about how both our birthday plans that year had been ruined by the bushfires. And finding out, you know, what people did outside of hospital as well. I think sometimes, especially when people are older and they're in a hospital bed, they can look very frail and vulnerable. And then you find out that actually this person gets up and swims, you know, 3 kilometres a day in the ocean. And you wouldn't have thought that just by looking at them in the bed. So I think actually taking that time to be able to find out about them in amongst, you know, and it's a busy day. You're trying to do so many things at once. There's various teams coming in to assess the patient and to see what the plan is going to be. And I think finding those moments of shared humanity felt really important.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Simone, your main focus was on non-COVID patients in ICU, but you did care for a young man with the disease. Tell me about that.
This was one of the first patients that I'd cared for who'd actually been diagnosed with COVID. And so it was still quite new for me in terms of caring for someone with COVID. And he was further through his COVID journey. He had actually contracted COVID from his child, from his school-age child. And so he was... He'd been very, very unwell. And, you know, he was not your stereotypical COVID patient. He was a young man. He was fit and healthy. He had none of those comorbidities that we normally associate with a serious illness. And yet he'd become very unwell very quickly. And he'd been intubated and ventilated for a fortnight. When I met him, he'd actually been extubated. So they'd taken the breathing tube out. But because his lungs were still so weak and he was still in that recovery phase, they'd actually given him a tracheostomy. So he was breathing through a hole in his neck. And you can imagine, like, I was meeting him on, I think it was day two after he'd woken up from this tracheostomy. So he'd been intubated for 2 weeks. He'd become sick, he'd become unwell, and then he'd woken up with a nurse and a tracheostomy. And so he was in a lot of shock. And on top of that, having been in bed for 2 weeks, completely not able to move, he was incredibly weak. So he wasn't able to talk. We were communicating with, you know, he was using, he had a whiteboard that he could write on and often through sign language. But every time I came in to see him, obviously we had to go through that very complicated process of putting on PPE. And so it's not like I could just duck into the room to get something for him. And at the point at which I met him, he actually had his bowels open in, I think it was probably close to 2 weeks as well, or 11 days, something like that. And that's one of the side effects sometimes of being intubated, is that a lot of these drugs can slow down your bowel motions. And so I'd explained to him that it was likely that this could happen today, but that when he did need to use his bowels, we'd need to get a team of people in to be able to turn him, to put him on the pan. And so we actually established some hand gestures so that if I was outside of the room, he could make a certain hand gesture if I needed to know that he needed the pan immediately. So the two of us had a bit of a chuckle over that. And I did have that moment when I was outside at the computer and he looked at me and he made eye contact through the glass. And he made this gesture and I could see on his face of like, okay, this is desperate. Now, please. But still, even in that moment, we have to go through all of that process. of putting on the PPE to get in. So I think he was doing some good holding on at that point.
And how did his health progress after that? What happened to him?
So one of the challenging things about working in intensive care is that you care for somebody on one day and then the next day you might care for someone that's different. And one of the reasons they do this in intensive care is they think it's important to have fresh eyes on a person every day. So the nurses change around a lot. So unfortunately, I only get a little snapshot of what his life was like on that day and can provide the support and care. But I don't actually know what happened after that in terms of his recovery. I do know that he left intensive care and he did go to the wards. And I really hope that he's doing well now.
How many days were you in at ICU over a week, Simone? Was it every day that you were travelling in?
I expected that I would end up working full-time or over full-time in the intensive care unit. But in actual fact, we didn't see the influx into intensive care that we'd seen in other areas. I think the Melbourne lockdown really was effective in preventing that. And so although we were busy and we were at capacity, I wasn't needed on every shift. As the pandemic progressed and we started to see more staff infections at the Royal Melbourne, I was actually then pulled into a separate role entirely of calling people who were in quarantine or who had been furloughed. So I was part of a team called the Staff Health Monitoring Team. And this team had been set up on the fly because we suddenly had huge volumes of staff who'd been close contacts of patients. We really expected in the hospitals to be completely over capacity in an intensive care setting. And we'd prepared so well for that. But we didn't expect to see the levels of COVID impact that we did in other areas of the hospital. So the team that I then was part of, the Staff Health Monitoring Team, was set up to support those staff members who'd been furloughed, who'd been quarantined, but also to support those staff members who'd contracted COVID. Someone described it as we tried to build an aeroplane while it was in the air. It was a team that had been cobbled together from senior nurses in the hospitals, OTs, social workers. We had doctors as part of the team. And every day we'd have a huddle in the morning to find out which staff on our list needed a phone call that day. And we started to work out how many phone calls were good to give to people. And it really varied. You know, we kind of judged the support really individually as to what each staff member needed. And for some of our staff who'd contracted COVID, they were really unwell. And being able to provide them with a nurse or a doctor that would call them each day to see how they were tracking and to refer them on to hospital in the home or to get them into emergency if needed was really important. But I guess we were also a bit of a logistics team. You know, we had to help people workshop. You know, you might have turned up at work and found out that you were close contact and told to go home and isolate. You weren't necessarily prepared to isolate. You hadn't necessarily worked out a plan of how that was going to happen in your household. And so even logistics of how pets were going to be fed and how children were going to be cared for and how were groceries going to get delivered, many people were really worried about their family and friends and what they'd potentially expose them to. You know, there were mothers with young children who were really worried about the risk to their family and who were also trying to care for and parent children through doors and interact with families through windows. So there was a lot of stress and worry about what does this mean. For a lot of the staff that had been out at Royal Park in the aged care setting, they were really also worried about their patients. These were people that they'd been caring for often quite long times. And then to suddenly find out those people had COVID and now they've been isolated and they didn't know how their patients were doing. And they were really worried about that. For other staff, they were really angry. You know, they felt like they had been unnecessarily exposed to COVID through whether it was through accident or whether it was through not knowing something, or they didn't feel like they'd been heard. There was also people feeling really stressed about what does this look like when I return to work? You know, is this something that's going to keep happening to me again? Could I be quarantined again? And for everyone who was quarantined, there was that feeling, do I have COVID? You know, every little like, is this a sore throat this morning? I'm feeling a bit sneezy. It could just be allergies. Could I potentially have COVID? That anxiety was really full on.
So your work as a nurse, Simone, was so important, but so demanding, so challenging. What was life at home like for you during these months?
It was a really intense time. And I was just reflecting on this the other day in terms of how much I appreciated my home life support. I live in a share house in Brunswick. I live with a school teacher and my partner, Emily, who was studying to be an osteopath. and a manager of ScienceWorks. And so it felt like my home was my sanctuary. I guess we all had our own little bubbles, but my home felt incredibly important. And I put a big shout out to my housemates because I was not the best housemate at times. There was a lot of incredible food that was cooked. And one of the interesting things was that, you know, as a busy household of working professionals, normally living in a share house, we got to have the occasional meal together, but everyone was normally busy and out. But over this period of time, you know, pretty much there was regular lunches and regular dinners where we'd all sit down together and talk about what had been happening that day. Whilst we were all working from home at that point, you know, because when I was doing the staff calls from quarantine and family violence, I was working from home. So, or if I'd come home from ICU, there was always a hot meal waiting for me and always people that were there to give me a hug after I'd showered. We had a very,
yeah,
very
how strict... careful did you have to be about infection? What was the process when you got home?
Incredibly careful. Like, I think early on, I had a discussion with my partner and housemates around what were the risks and how are we going to respond to this? And luckily, we have a laundry door that's open to the back of the house. So I could come in through the laundry door and I could strip in the laundry, close straight in the washing machine, and then a bit of a naked dash into the bathroom, which was close by. And so then from there, coming out of the bathroom felt like you weren't bringing anything into the house. But, you know, I had to take changes of clothes into work so I wasn't cycling home in my scrubs. I had to make sure that anything that I was taking into, especially when I was working in ICU, anything I was taking into that environment, whether it was my lanyard tags or my water bottle, all had to be wiped down and kept separately. I made sure that I kept my shoes somewhere separate in the house as well, so that there was none of that cross-contamination that was happening. It took a lot of brain space.
Besides hot meals and conversations with your partner and your flatmate, what else helped you keep sane, Simone? Like, how did you keep yourself recharged and able to face this work day after day?
Usual things that I do for my mental health are often quite physical. So I love doing yoga and I really, really love doing Acrobalance, which is something that I do through the Women's Circus, which is where I connect with an amazing group of women and trans and non-binary people, and we climb on each other and we hold each other in the air. And I feel like that's so important to my mental health. And that was something that I couldn't do over COVID in terms of that physical connection with people outside of my household. I even felt like my normal ways of coping, which involve calling lots of people and chatting to friends and chatting to family and debriefing, really cut back. I remember there was a really intense time when I was working potentially like 14 days straight. And look, this was no hospital made me work 14 days straight. I was working at three different organizations, so I was choosing to pick up that work, but it felt important. And I remember during that time, people were texting me, a lot of friends and family, and were reaching out, hope you're doing okay, let me know if there's anything I can do to help, because they knew how busy it was. I just reached a point where even replying to a text felt like too much work. And I set up something where I would just text that person's name to my partner, Emily, and Emily would write to them and say, hey, someone got your message, thanks for... Because it's so interesting thinking about being that busy that I just really had to focus on the job at hand, what I needed to do, and making sure that I had food and sleep. And that at times was really all I could do.
What about the conversations you had with Elsa, who's written this book, Care Factor? Were they helpful?
Oh, they were incredibly helpful. So it was the 23rd of March last year when Elsa first called me and suggested maybe the way that she could help me as a friend, knowing what was coming, was to provide a regular phone debrief. And in some ways that was just a lifeline, because it meant that there was someone that was regularly going to be there that I could have these conversations with. It felt quite hard having conversations with lots of different people because it meant telling stories over and over again. But having one person who I had dedicated time with that was allocated to have a debrief about my day just felt, it felt like an absolute godsend. And I have really clear memories of after shifts walking around the neighborhood with my earbuds in, tears streaming down my face, all laughing hysterically because it's just gotten all too much. And just being able to share those moments with Ailsa. I also think that the process of sharing that with Ailsa and the process that happened since in terms of what we've done together with that, with those stories, has been incredibly therapeutic. I think there's something about being able to reflect on your experiences and talk through them and have them documented as well that really helped me process those feelings.
How long had you two been friends, Simone?
I couldn't even give you a time frame on that. We've been friends for a long, long time, and I think we've been friends in each other's wider orbit for much longer as well. But we really became close friends probably over the last 9 or 10 years through Women's Circus, where we've actually been in shared acrobalance classes together.
So you've got to know each other through standing on each other's shoulders.
And hanging off trapeze. Holding over her head, and I climb on her shoulders and I dangle from her feet, and she's a good base and I like being a flyer, so we work well together.
As well as you mentioned, as well as your work on the ICU unit, you were also continuing your work with sexual health and with family violence. How had those areas been affected by COVID and the lockdown? What were you seeing in those other parts of your nursing world?
I think the thing is that COVID impacted everything that was happening, and the ways in which we were working in every role got impacted and changed. So within my family violence role, so I'm a family violence educator at the Royal Melbourne Hospital, and my job is to train staff to recognise and respond to family violence. And we used to run this training face-to-face. I would turn up in wards and clinical areas and chat to staff about it, and obviously that wasn't possible anymore. And so because there was so much training happening around other things to do with COVID, unfortunately the family violence training had to take a bit of a sidestep for a while because of those other really important things that were coming in. But we also knew in the family violence sector, we knew that it was likely that family violence incidents would increase and worsen over this time. We've seen this with other disasters like bushfires and other natural disasters that have happened. And what we were seeing out of China and from other countries was that this was true. This had, family violence had increased. It doesn't cause violence. I want to be really clear about that, but it creates the conditions where it's more likely to occur. And it also makes it much harder for people to be able to seek help. So it also felt really important to me that we still kept a level of family violence education going. And, you know, I remember constructing an email early in the pandemic where I just really wanted people to know that this was still going to be important and what services we had in the hospital to respond to this. But I agonized over this email that I was going to send out because there was so much information traffic coming through the organization. I didn't want my email to be something else people are like, oh gosh, too much to read. I wanted it to be really clear and succinct.
Were you hearing stories from nurses that intensification you'd feared would happen was happening?
Yeah, it was. We were hearing stories not only from nurses but from the social service sector as well. Call lines like 1-800-RESPECT and Men's Referral Service were seeing, you know, a huge increase in call volume, particularly at midnight when people were finding that was maybe the only safe time while, you know, the family member that was abusing them was asleep. We knew that the family violence services such as InTouch and Safe Steps were experiencing huge increase in case management needs. And what we were seeing in the hospital initially, it really scared us initially because we saw a real drop in family violence presentations. And I think this was to do with people feeling unsure about going to hospital because COVID was happening and you know, was it a safe place to go? And so there was a lot of messaging being put out by the government and by health organisations saying it is still, you are allowed to leave your home to seek help around family violence. Unfortunately, as the lockdown progressed, we saw a severity in presentations around family violence in terms of trauma presentations. But really, we know that family violence isn't all physical. And in actual fact, a lot of coercive control behaviours can be incredibly dangerous and damaging to people. And we started to see in the second lockdown, we saw some studies done from the first lockdown that we had in Melbourne showing that there had been an increase in coercive controlling behaviours that people were experiencing and also that people were really worried about seeking help for safety concerns. So a lot of it we're still finding out. You know, a lot of the data is still just coming through in terms of what happened in the family violence sector and what was happening in terms of violence against women, but we were definitely seeing an increase and it was really hard for many people.
I want to ask you about sexual violence within your own profession, within nursing. How common is it for nurses to face sexual harassment at work?
Unfortunately, it is. It's really quite common. And this is something that I've experienced myself across my nursing career, particularly when I was a junior nurse. And I have a cousin who followed me into nursing, and so many years later when she started as a nurse and she experienced sexual harassment and sexual violence at work, that was the thing that really stoked a fire in my belly to go, actually, we've been tolerating this for a really long time. There is a bit of a culture, I think, in nursing that is changing for sure, but a an older school culture of like, you just brush it off, you get on with it. It doesn't matter. It's not about you. It's not personal. Just kind of get over it, let it go. And I think really we haven't, as a profession, looked at the damaging impact that that has on us, but and also looked at the opportunity we have as nurses to speak out against sexual harassment. And so when this happened to my cousin and I really got quite angry about it, I started seeing stories everywhere. And I was working as an educator at the time, and I had some junior nurses who were also reporting to me things that had happened to them. And it felt really important to speak out about it. And when I heard about a book that was being written, an anthology of hashtag MeToo stories in Australia, I spoke to Ailsa about it, my friend who's the author, and we decided that we wanted to write something together and share these stories. And as part of that, it was actually published on the ABC as an article, and it was shared widely. And after that, I received an inundation of phone calls and messages and emails from people sharing with me their stories. And I remember one of the messages came in. She said, "You mentioned this." This was from a nurse. And she said, "You mentioned this topic in any tea room and stories will erupt. Everyone has a story." But I think for nurses, when it comes from a patient and it's someone that you're caring for, and, you know, it might start out as a bit of a joke, just a bit of someone having a bit of fun, or it might be quite intense, it's very hard to know how to progress with that. And especially when you add in the added complication of, does this person have a condition that might mean they are less able to filter what's going on? Do they have dementia? Do they have delirium? Is there something going on for them that might be impacting on this? And in some cases, there are some cases where, yes, the behaviour is not able to be controlled and it's not that person's choice either. It's part of whatever's happening to them neurologically. But in many cases, the behaviour can be changed, and in many cases, it's actually quite deliberate. And I've done a lot of thinking about this and wondering about why this happens, particularly to nurses. And it happens to all female health professionals, but it happens particularly to women in my experience. And I wonder if there's something about the intimacy of nursing. You know, it's often behind closed doors. It can be in bathrooms with curtains pulled. And I wonder if there's something about sexual harassment and sexual violence as a way of asserting control. You know, if someone's in a bed, you know, if there's a man in a bed and power has been taken away from him in that hospital bed, maybe subconsciously it's a way of shifting that power dynamic. But I also think if there's someone who's been sexually harassing nurses or making inappropriate comments, being sexually aggressive, I'm sure it's not just to nurses. I'm sure there's been other people in their life, whether it's their air host or their waitress or the person who comes and cleans their house. And that's where I think we have such a huge responsibility as nurses and an opportunity to speak up about this collectively, because we're actually speaking about violence against women. And we're actually saying this is not okay and this is not something that we are going to tolerate, so that nurses aren't left alone with patients like I was as a grad nurse, where they were saying things that have been seared into my memory.
It's a year now, Simone, since you first saw those news stories when you're on holiday with your family in WA about COVID. We've now got the vaccine, which is in the process of being rolled out across Australia. How are you and your colleagues feeling a year into this?
Oh, I think it's been such an extraordinary collective experience that we've gone through together. But it's also been an incredibly diverse experience, and it's impacted people in such different ways. And I know that some of my colleagues are still really struggling with what's happened and what could happen. I know that the vaccine is being rolled out and that's going to be a real game changer. And we've made such huge changes in terms of how we respond to COVID within hospitals. We've got new technology. We've got things that are going to help us in the future stop the spread of COVID. But we also haven't ruled out the possibility of a third wave. And I think for many healthcare professionals, there is this feeling of going, could I do that again? You know, we're not at a point where we've got through this and it's at that big group hug and we're all like, yes, it's all done. This could very easily change. There could be a variant that happens. There could be outbreaks that happen. And I guess we're all hoping that it doesn't, but also the hospital still is in preparation mode for a third wave. And I think the toll that it's taken on everyone collectively is really huge. And it's not like, I think this is the thing too, it's not like we can all go and have a lovely holiday now. healthcare continues. And in actual fact, it's been busier in the hospital than it's ever been. We're trying to catch up with elective surgery. There's a lot of people that hadn't presented to hospital with signs and symptoms that are now illnesses that are quite advanced that are needing treatment. And so it's back to being business as usual, but also probably busier than business as usual with the added precautions that have now come in through COVID as well. So I think for many of us, we're still quite tired.
Yeah, I was going to say, how tired are you? How exhausted are you?
I had a lovely week in Perth with my family at the end of last year. I managed to sneak it in right between when the Perth borders were open, and I had a bit of time up in the mountains, up near Mount Hotham over my birthday as well. And it felt so extraordinary to be away from Melbourne, but also to be in a place where I could look long distance, physically look across mountains. It just blew me away after a year of kind of not looking further than my computer screen or a bedside or the end of my street. But I think coming back from that bit of leave and back into work, I really recognised in myself that there is a level of deep exhaustion. And I think as much as we're trying to kind of push on and get everything back and make everything happen again, I think as healthcare professionals, but people in generally that have gone through this, we also need to know that it's okay to take stock and it's okay to take time. And, you know, I was always someone who had a jam-packed calendar. Like, I loved my weekends being full of a yoga and a brunch date and then off to see a show and then catching up with friends in the evening. And I've really noticed that I've pulled back from that level. I like to have at least one day in my weekend now that feels free for me to be able to settle.
And when things hopefully continue to get easier in terms of time off or travel, what's that kind of little dream you've got somewhere in the back of your head, or bring into your life something that's not happening yet?
I have so many that I would like to, things I'd like to get back to doing again. Something that my partner and I really enjoy are camper vanning trips, either around New Zealand or Tasmania, somewhere with beautiful mountains. And a very good friend of mine was going to get married in Scotland at the end of last year, which obviously didn't happen. And it is my dream that I make it back for that wedding and potentially combine that with a campervanning trip through the north of Scotland and, yeah, just get to be in wild open spaces.
I very much hope that gets to happen, Simone. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.